You're now listening to Sound Talent Media. Check out more shows at soundtalentmedia.com.
Welcome to a very special episode 10 of Fly on the Call, candid conversations on music. This week is special, not just because it's another milestone as far as episode count, double digits, but it's also by far the longest discussion on the podcast to date, and for good reason. Today, I'm extremely excited to feature a conversation with Shane Told of Silverstein, diving deep on the 10-year anniversary of their album, A Shipwreck in the Sand. The anniversary was technically back in March, but that was before this podcast was even a thought in my head. This is my favorite album by one of my favorite bands, and I was so happy to be able to nerd out with Shane for an hour and a half. For those unfamiliar, the overarching story of this concept album is that of a man with an illness who finds out that his wife is cheating on him, and sets fire to his own home with his wife and child still inside. There's much more to the story that's hit on throughout the conversation, and much of the narrative is open to interpretation, so I highly suggest you check out the album yourself. Before we get into the interview, I want to let you know about a contest that I'm running to celebrate 10 episodes. I will be giving away 3 prize packs of a magnet, pin, and 2 sticker bundle. And because the podcast has officially hit 500 plays, there will also be a grand prize of the same combo, plus a copy of A Shipwreck in the Sand in the format of your choosing, vinyl, CD, or digital. All you need to do is go to twitter.com/flyonthecallpod, retweet the pinned tweet, and reply to it with a quick sentence letting me know what your favorite episode of Fly on the Call is and why. A link will also be in the show notes. And if you send me a screenshot of you rating and reviewing the podcast on Apple Podcasts, that's worth an extra 3 entries. The deadline is next Tuesday, November 12th at 8 p.m. Eastern, and the winner will be announced in episode 11. And now, without further ado, here's my interview with Shane Told of Silverstein. Because Shipwreck is like such a concept record, and obviously we're going to be talking about that a lot. Could you start off with just like a quick summary for people who may not know the record?
Yeah, it's what's been referred to, I guess, as a high concept record. Whatever the fuck that really means, I don't know. But I guess like it's very involved, you know. They're kind of, sometimes you'll have a concept record where, you know, a couple of the songs don't fit into the story as much, or like they're, all the songs are kind of like about, you know, a certain theme that's kind of like makes it a concept record. But this album tells a story from start to finish, you know, kind of one, kind of like a movie, you know, or a book like that. And it never wavers from that, except for a couple, you know, flashback sort of songs. And there's a few musical themes throughout it as well. But that's kind of the gist, I guess.
Cool. And I'm curious, like, how much of the album was kind of in reaction to arrivals and departures? I was kind of surprised in like my research that you never really shied away from like discussing the issues surrounding that album.
No, that's, you know, if people that know me, I'm pretty honest and I'm pretty forthright, and I don't really hide, you know, my true feelings, about, you know, things, you know, with Silverstein that I've gone through or whatever. I think that if you're a fan of my band, that's great, you know, cause I, you know, I'm an open book. Arrivals and Departures was a real shit time, to be honest, man. We wrote these songs and I think we thought they were okay. I don't know. I think that we had a lot of confidence coming off of Discovering the Waterfront. And we thought, like, you know, we wrote the songs kind of the same way we wrote Discovering the Waterfront. So we kind of thought it was all going to be fine. And we had a producer with Arrivals and Departures where he wasn't super involved in the producing part of it. You know, he didn't really change any of the songs or have suggestions. He kind of just recorded the songs, and they weren't recorded with very much I don't know. There wasn't much next level going on with the recording. It was like we got two guitars and we got a bass and drums and vocals. And then when we did Shipwreck in the Sand, we went back to the Discovering the Waterfront producer, Cameron Webb. And it was very, very involved. You know, we brought in cellos and electric cellos, and we were using all these different like sorts of samples and between songs. And it was like there was a lot more going on. And we spent a lot more time on the record. In fact, we had so much time when we did Shipwreck in the Sand that there were like entire days where I would work on like one guitar lead, like 8 hours for one guitar lead that in the end of the record, there's so many layers of different tracks. You can't even really even hear it. The one I'm talking about. So, you know, it really was, you know, I don't know if you used the term reactionary, Ravel's Departures, but that's absolutely what it was. I mean, we ran out of time on Ravel's Departures. We were like, there's no fucking way that's happening again. We booked like 2 solid months in the studio in Toronto as well. That's another thing we did is we recorded Shipwreck in the Sand in Toronto, not in Los Angeles like we'd done the previous 2 records, because we found LA was, there's a lot of distractions. You know, recording in LA, there's just so many things going on and friends and, you know, Ravel's and Departures, we were kind of partying like while we were making the record. And I think that's, you chose on that record, that it was, I don't know, gotcha. it was not a good record. And then A Shipwreck in the Sand for me, you know, at the time that we made it, and even all these years later, 10 years later, I think that record still holds up really, really well.
Yeah, definitely. It was actually like the first record that came out after when I was like fully into Silverstein. So it definitely holds like a special place in my heart in that way.
Yeah, it's to me, it's kind of the, I think it was at the time by far our best record we ever made. We had made, you know, and was super proud of it. And it was a challenging record. I mean, there's a lot going on, man. So it was not an easy record either. But there was a lot more focus, and I think that I really felt I had something to prove, you know, with it. After Ravel's Departures was such a, you know, just not a good experience.
You mentioned like all the time you had in the studio, and I know like when I was doing my research, I saw a lot of like talk about kind of focusing on a lot of like the little details in the album and transitions and stuff like that. And yeah, it was like kind of the first time you guys had an emphasis on the guest vocalists with like Liam from Cancer Bats and Scott from Comeback Kid and Lights. How did that, like the recording process, kind of affect all of that and like allow like for that experimentation?
Well, I mean, we had, like I said before, we had a lot of time, and we put a lot of time into crafting the songs and the arrangements. And what was kind of a bit unique was the music was pretty much completely done. But there was no, like, I hadn't written any lyrics at all yet. So what was kind of cool is I was able to take all these instrumental songs, some of which that I had written and some of which the other guys had written, you know, we'd written together. And I was able to say, okay, now that we have these, you know, whatever it was, like 12 songs and the 2 little extra interludes that we put in, once we have those together, it was like, okay, now I'm going to write this entire thing. You know, I'm going to take this story that I've sort of, I guess, storyboarded, you know, made an idea of like kind of where in the plot, where the different events are going to take place. And once that kind of all came together, it was cool because then it was like, okay, we're going to cement this song as, let's say, you know, well, A Great Fire. We knew that was going to be track one, and this certain thing had to happen. And then in Vices, which is track two, this certain thing. So there was no changing the track listing later. We had committed pretty much as I was writing the lyrics to the entire record, the way it was written before we had started recording anything. So the first three albums we had done, and even, you know, albums we did after that, we didn't, when you're recording a record, you don't necessarily know, okay, this is going to be track one or this is going to be track 11. You know, you record the songs and then afterwards you say, okay, what is, you know, how is this going to work? So committing to that early, and then also, like, a lot of people don't know this, especially if you're listening on like Spotify or something, but it was actually split into four chapters as well. So the first three songs all kind of blended in together, and then there was a break. The next three, and then there was, you know, or four, and then there was a break, and that was kind of like another kind of, you know, I thought was kind of an interesting way to do the map out the record. And yeah, so that was kind of how we started with the writing process. And then, you know, it was kind of like going back and forth between, like, okay, if we're going to tweak something musically, then the lyrics are affected, and then the concept is therefore affected. So there was a lot of back and forth between kind of figuring out what the lyrics were going to do and the music, and then the, you know, overall the story as well. So instead of just a regular record that bands have made, you know, thousands of times, if not millions of times, where you kind of just write music and write words and then that's a song, this, you know, with the concept, it was almost like there was a third, you know, a third thing on top of the, you know, music and lyrics.
Yeah, and I actually read in, I think it was like one of the interviews that I read with either you or Paul, that you talked about kind of like when writing the music itself, you had it in mind like that you were servicing the album as a whole rather than each song as a separate entity. So you kind of had more leeway with like the structure as far as straying away a little bit more from like the verse, chorus, verse kind of style. Could you talk a little bit more about that and how that changed?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, it was really important not only that this story and this idea worked in terms of being a linear story and there being characters and there being growth of, you know, characters throughout the album. That was all very important. But at the same time, it was very important for each song to stand on its own. In the context of like, well, what if, you know, someone's just got this on a mix CD or like, you know, I mean, nowadays on, you know, Spotify on shuffle, like something could come on and I didn't want it to be like, oh, this doesn't make any sense in terms of its being its own entity, you know? So like a song like Born Dead, for example, which is, you know, one of my favorite songs on the record, that song is pretty much about, you know, the U.S. healthcare system or lack thereof. And that song kind of stands on its own, making that point about that, which is funny because it's been 10 years and it's still like a number one, one of the number one issues in the country. But, you know, that issue and having that be there on its own in the context of one song, I think that it does a great job and stands on its own as saying something. And in the context of the entire record, it's also a really important part of the story, you know, because this is kind of when you realize about the whole, you know, medical like issues that are going on, you know, within the character. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so that's just an example of that, which was hard. It's really hard, you know, because like, you know, it wasn't always easy to be able to have put in all the little things you needed and then have them not be like sort of random in the context of one song. But overall, I felt like I did a pretty good job of making those songs kind of pop on their own. And, you know, nobody would have foreseen streaming and shuffling and all this that is taking place, you know, now. No one knew that was going to happen, but it's kind of good that I did think about that more, you know, like there was talk of for example, having the album, instead of being 14 tracks, have it only be four. So the entire first three songs are one track, which would have been kind of crazy, I think. It would have been unique. I don't know of really any records that have ever done that, you know, but the idea was like, okay, well, people need to hear the whole, you know, hear this whole chapter to understand the concept. And I was like, you know what? I don't think so. I think each of these songs, you know, can stand on their own.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, that makes a lot of sense. And was Broken Stars, was that originally written during the Arrivals and Departures cycle?
Ah, you called me out on the one exception. Yes. Yes. It was. And that's I'm glad that you called me out and brought that up. So yeah, Broken Stars was a song. It was actually the first song that I completed the lyrics for Arrivals and Departures. I wrote it on an airplane. I remember very well how it. I had this music and I was like really hot on it. I thought it was like a really, really cool song musically, and I'd written it, and I wrote it on an airplane, and I wrote it all, just kind of. I've never done this before or since. I was, you know, usually when I'm writing like lyrics and a melody to a song, I have a guitar with me and I'm able to kind of sing or hum, you know, the melody I want. I wrote this like with headphones listening to it, like to the music. And then I wrote the words and I kind of just like in my head, like I just kind of like not visualized, but I just kind of like thought about how the melody would go. And obviously like rhythmically, you know how many syllables something has to be to fit in a part, but melodically, like you kind of don't. So I kind of knew it was going to be like, my mind's made up. Like I knew that was going to be there, but I didn't know if the melody was going to be what the melody was going to be like. It was just in my head. So it's kind of a unique song. So I wrote that and, you know, showed it to the guys and like, and the producer, and they like weren't feeling it. And, which is funny, because I think if that song was on Arrivals and Departures, it would be like by far the best song. But yeah, they like weren't feeling it. And I don't know if it was because it was the first song or like that they'd heard or what, but like I got like kind of a weird vibe. So we recorded, you know, the other 11 songs. And then we recorded these other two for that record that were on like a Best Buy exclusive. One was called Rain Will Fall, and the other was called Falling Down. So those songs were recorded, and you know, we kind of knew those were weaker songs, so they were sort of like B-sides. And then Broken Stars was recorded too, but it was recorded like those songs weren't recorded as well either. And I actually recorded the vocals later with my friend producer later on, actually. Because the producer for Arrivals and Departures we were on such a time crunch, we didn't have time to finish the vocals for that. So anyway, I know I'm going like way off here, but so that song, Broken Stars, I always believed in it as like just a really cool song. Like I thought I had a lot of life to it. I thought it was catchy, and I like loved the ending, you know, kind of the breakdown part. Kind of reminded me of Hatebreed or something. So I really liked the song, and I didn't want it to just kind of be a B-side and fall through the cracks. So I decided, okay, we'll put these other two, Falling Down and Rain Will Fall, we'll put those on the, as the kind of, you know, throwaway B-sides for the Best Buy exclusive. And they really were throwaway tracks for a long time. Like until now, when, you know, everything's on streaming services, like nobody really even knew those songs. And I didn't want that to happen with Broken Stars. So when we started writing the album, and I had that song done, and I had the lyrics done, for the most part, I think. I don't know how much of it I changed, but I kind of felt like it could fit in the it could kind of fit in with the story in that three hole. Kind of where the transition between like Vices and I guess the next song is American Dream. I kind of felt like there was a place for it. And that's the one thing that, like, when I've told people, and I haven't told that many people that I wrote that song before for the other record, they said, well, how does this make sense if you're writing this concept record? And that was the one exception to the rule where I, you know, I cheated a little bit, I guess.
Yeah, I feel like it stands out like slightly just based on, because I mean, Shipwreck is kind of like the heaviest record that at the time, especially, but even yeah. Now in some ways. So I feel like it definitely, you can see that it came from, or see how it could have come from like another session. But that's cool that you were able to bring it back.
Yeah, yeah.
And interesting to see how it fit into that, like the process of the writing the record.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And it's a song that I think we probably played live. Well, maybe Vices we played the most live on that record, but Broken Stars is another one that's, you know, became like a staple of our live set, and it was, you know, definitely an important song for that record. So I'm kind of glad that shook out the way it did. Although for a while I did wonder, like, okay, maybe if Broken Stars was, you know, track three on Arousal Departures, maybe that record would have, you know, had more to it. But maybe not, you know, maybe that song being heavier and stuff, you know, set the tone a little bit for the Shipwreck in the Sand writing. I'm not sure.
Oh, and I know you had like released the like demo version of Broken Stars back, I think it was like October 2008, before the album was released in like March 2009.
Really released it?
Well, you like released it on, put it up on MySpace.
Weird. Okay.
And so like at that time, do you know if it was planned to be part of the record, or was it kind of to hold people over for the new record?
You know what? I my memory is usually really good for all this stuff. And now that you say that, maybe I do vaguely remember us having that out. And I think it was probably like a holdover. But we must have known it was going to be on the record. We must have known that. I think. I don't know. That is kind of weird. And I remember the demo version of the vocals were pretty bad. Like, I did it really quickly. So I'm surprised that we released it. But I guess, yeah, I don't know. It was a different world back then, you know?
Yeah, for sure.
We didn't have a lot. We never had a lot of, like, extra stuff. Like, you hear about bands that record, like, you know, almost entire records worth of material that like stuff never sees the light of day. We were never that band, like ever. So for us to have that song kicking around was probably for us was probably like kind of like we were like, oh, this is like weird. We have this. Why, like, you know, what are we doing with it? If it's just kicking around, maybe we should, you know, show people. I guess. So that's probably was our thinking. But yeah, it's kind of funny looking back now at that.
Yeah, definitely. And you mentioned it being kind of like a different world back then. I thought like the rollout of the album was kind of interesting. Like I saw a lot of places from back in 2009, like referring to it as like a viral marketing campaign, the way you like teased the track list and chapter titles and then had clips of a couple songs and then did the actual like the full stream on MySpace, which was kind of like ahead of its time considering how like prevalent premieres became. Can you talk a little bit about that like rollout?
Yeah. Well, I remember I had written it was partly from the like title track. I don't know if it was the actually like what I speak in the title track or if it was something like sort of parts of that. But we wrote this thing and I remember we signed it with our initials, like our five initials or something like that. I think we did that. Unless I'm mixing that up with something else. But anyway, we released this kind of thing. It was like somebody, you know, and we didn't say who that was our band, and everybody thought that it was brand new. So, and I can sort of see that because that brand new song about like the ship and say that the captain or like, you know, that song on the end of, at the end of Deja Entendu. I think that because of the Shipwreck in the Sand and the references to like sailors and stuff, people were really like it was kind of a you talk about viral marketing, it definitely worked because there was a lot of speculation on, you know, at that time it was like, I guess, social media and like message boards and stuff. There's a lot of talk of like, okay, who is this? And so nobody knew it was us for a while. And then I remember Jason from Absolute Punk, it's kind of a shitty thing for him to do actually, but I guess, you know, he doesn't care, but he posted like a graphic of Silver Surfer, like in the comments. And since it was like, he was running the website, you know, the Absolute Punk website, then everyone's like, oh, so Jason knows who it is because the news was submitted to him or whatever. So he kind of leaked that it was us. And then once he did that, everyone's like, oh, Silverstein, like, you know, they suck and their last record was horrible and whatever, right? So that was kind of how that shook out, I remember. And I remember when I wrote it, you write a thing and it's a big long thing and you don't always like check. And I remember I used woman, like M-E-N instead of woman, like at one point. So I made like a grammatical error and people were like, there's no way Brand New would ever make a grammatical error in their like, you know, statement or whatever. Like, and it's like, I remember that. I remember just reading that and being like, that's like funny. And then thinking to myself, how do I fuck that up? But, you know, it was, we did do that. And I think, yeah, I don't remember exactly that the whole like rolling it out with the stream. I feel like we did that like a lot of times. That was kind of a thing you do like the day before you'd release the record. Yeah. Like on a MySpace stream. And then, you know, hopefully that was hyping it up. But I remember the other thing too was it was our last album for Victory, on our contract. So we were effectively like free agents after this record was released. And, Tony, the owner of Victory, he really wanted us to re-sign. And we were like, well, you know, we were pretty done with Victory at that point. You know, we'd had some issues and we'd done four records and we were such a young band when we signed. It was like, okay, now finally, it's like, you know, it's like the baseball player. Like, it's like Bryce Harper when, you know, he's finally done his contract with the Washington Nationals and he's like, okay, well, it's not that I don't want to play for the Washington Nationals. It's that I want to kind of go around and take meetings and kick tires, you know, and see what else is out there, you know? And ultimately he signed with the Phillies, but you know, it was that kind of a thing where we were like, okay, well, we want to see what else is out there, but Victory didn't like that. And I understand from their perspective that, okay, well, if this band isn't coming back, if we don't have any future interest in this band's music, well, we're not going to promote it as much as we are if we do. You know what I mean? It just makes sense. Mm-hmm. So for that, I think that the record sort of didn't get pushed as hard as the other records at all. And that was kind of too bad because I was like, you know, this record is way beyond anything we've done. This record should be selling, like this should sell more than Arrivals and Departures, you know, the first week. And it didn't. So the record didn't, you know, at that point our records had continued, like they'd sold more and more. Like, even Arrivals and Departures, a lot of people don't know that. Like it had a bigger first week than Discovering the Waterfront did. So we were expecting, I think, bigger. And then when the record didn't do super well in the first week, I think we were all kind of like bummed on that because we'd put so much into the album and, you know, we thought that kind of all the stuff we'd done around it had been, you know, good. And we thought the music videos we made were like way better than, you know, some of the ones we'd done before. Not that they're great now, but, you know, it was like, they're all pretty, all our videos are pretty terrible, but there was just a lot there that we thought was better. So it was kind of too bad that the record didn't come out with a bang. It really did grow over time and word of mouth, you know, people, you know, it legitimized our band, I think, a lot. And it made so people, like, they started to take Discovering the Waterfront more serious as a record, I think, because they knew we were capable of the stuff that we did on Shipwreck in the Sand. So it really did like kind of bolster our, I think, our fan base and cement us as kind of a real band, like a career band. Even though the success we had waned a little bit, like we had fallen off with in terms of like the sales. And I think even our shows, like the headliner we did in 2009 actually didn't even do that well. Like we were used to selling out every show we played when we headlined, like entire tours sold out. And then in 2009, I think we like only sold out, you know, we just sold out the shows like we always sell out, like California and, you know, New York and stuff, and Chicago maybe. So it was like, oh shit, like, are we falling off? Like, is this thing, you know, is this kind of going away now? So there was a fear there as well, you know, from the business side of things.
Yeah, that's really interesting, like you talking about kind of like how it was perceived at the time and everything, because like going back through like old reviews and everything, I was seeing a bunch of people being like, oh, Screamo's dead, but Silverstein's somehow still doing it. And like a lot of people kind of saying like, oh, Rivals was horrible, but now hopefully they'll gain some of their fan base back. So it's really interesting just like kind of seeing the differences in the way it was taken at the time versus how it is now.
Yeah, I agree. And I mean, I haven't done what you've done. I haven't looked back at that stuff. I'm sure it would be very interesting though, you know, to see. But I do remember though that was a thing too, that Screamo was all of a sudden like, it was like all of a sudden a thing, and then all of a sudden it was not like dead. You know, it was like, there wasn't like a big window of time when it was like a thing. It seemed like people were rejecting the term. And then right when it was like, maybe people were accepting it, they all of a sudden it was over. And we never like really cared about the way that bands, that like anyone was labeling us, whether it was emo or screamo or post-hardcore, or like, I fucking still don't know what we are. but the fact remains that we never left, you know. We started in the year 2000, and it's been almost 20 years that we've been a band, like all the time doing this. We never went away, we never broke up, we never took hiatus. So for us, you know, we were just doing the same thing. And I guess, like, you know, if you think of it as 10 years ago, so that's like half of our career ago, with this album, you know, I think at the time we weren't really concerned with that, you know, of what people were saying. And at the time too, a lot of people weren't expecting us to make like a heavier record. I think that what tended to happen back then was a lot of the bands that were like the screamo bands or whatever, they started making records with less screaming. Like, I remember Senses Fail put out a record that was way, like, had hardly any screaming on it. And, you know, it seemed like that was what everyone was trying to do. You know, people were trying to get on the radio, and there was never going to be screaming on the radio, was the theory. And so everyone's writing, you know, trying to write that softer stuff. And so when we came out with the heavier record, I think people were really like, oh shit, like this is kind of cool that this band doesn't give a fuck about, you know, that. And then we were like, oh, and then when we started being less successful, we were like, man, damn, maybe we should have written some more poppy shit, you know? But there were bands, but the bands that were getting big that were coming out were heavier bands, like Devilish Prada, who we took on tour, and A Day to Remember we took on tour, and I don't know who else, August Burns Red was getting big at that time. And a lot of these bands were like, oh, it was like, okay, this is screaming. Like, some of these bands only scream. Parkway Drive was another one. And it's like, okay, well, if these bands are getting popular and they just scream, then, you know, there is like a market for like the heavier stuff, you know?
Yeah. So was it like kind of purposeful on your end to kind of like double down and make the record heavier, or did that kind of happen a little more like naturally?
I think it was more natural. We didn't really like talk about it, but I think Arrivals was a poppier record, and that just, I don't know, that just sort of happened too. So maybe it was a bit of a, maybe it was a bit of a reaction to that. Like we didn't, you know, but it wasn't like we didn't force, force the heavy stuff, like something like I Am the Arsonist, which is maybe, you know, one of the heaviest songs we've ever done. That song came out pretty naturally. There was no, you know, there was no talk of like, okay, we're going to do this, this metal song and, you know, it just kind of happened.
Yeah, definitely. And I mean, this was like the first, concept record that you guys did. And I know you've said before kind of how the planning process kind of was really hard on you and you thought you might never do it again. But I mean, since you've done This Is How the Wind Shifts and I Am Alive and Everything I Touch, which are kind of like their own unique concepts. But can you like reflect a little bit on what you learned from the process of writing Shipwreck and like how that changed and influenced the process for the other concept albums?
Yeah, absolutely. I remember I was in Las Vegas by the pool. I'm not sure which hotel, but by the pool, and I had my notebook, and I remember it was like, okay, I got to start thinking about, you know, getting some lyrics together for this record. And that's when something hit me in my head. I think it was actually kind of started from the whole U.S. healthcare thing that was going on at the time. Because politically, you know, this was right before Obama got elected, right? When we were writing this. I think Obama got elected while we were recording.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Or at least, yeah, I think he was or at least he was maybe not elected, but he was like, you know, sworn in at the time. Mm-hmm. So there was a lot of stuff, like a lot of talk, you know, at that time about the healthcare system. And Obama, like one of his main things was that, and I remember him saying this, he said, you know, healthcare is not a privilege. It's a right. I believe that healthcare is a right, not a privilege. And that's the literally the first lyrics of Born Dead, which I guess I'm quoting Obama, which, you know, this is something he said, you know, on the campaign trail, you know. So I had a lot of opinions about it because I'm Canadian and we have universal health care and it's great and I don't have to worry about anything. And it was really like kind of disheartening to me when I started understanding more about the U.S. system and, you know, I knew some friends of mine that like had been in car accidents and like fucking gone bankrupt and shit because they didn't have health insurance, which to me is like, it was so insane to me that that was a thing. So I started doing a little bit of like kind of research and thinking about it. And then I think that that's kind of where I came up with this, with the concept for this character who had, you know, had medical issues and like, you know, not just physically, but also like mental health issues that he was kind of unable to get any sort of, you know, care, based on the system. And then just sort of how that could, you know, affect a man and his family, you know, or I shouldn't say man, but a person and his family, or their family, you know, in my case, it's a man. So that's why I use that terminology. But so that's kind of where it all came from. And I remember just sort of starting to write it out and saying, okay, like there's this, maybe what if there's an event, like a big, you know, something that happens. And it made me think of the, a little bit of in Fight Club when Edward Norton's character, when he, there's like a apartment, like explosion, like a bomb goes off in his apartment and he's like, he doesn't have anywhere to go because, you know, he I don't know. He's like, he's dealing with the insurance companies and all this stuff. Right. And like, obviously later you find out that he did the whole thing himself. Spoiler for anyone that hasn't seen Fight Club. Sorry about that. But so that actually, I guess, was sort of another sort of way that I, another sort of idea that I borrowed for the concept was the, was this sort of idea that there was this big event. So, you know, that you couple that, and then you have like the relationship with his wife and all that too. So I started writing this, this kind of like just these ideas down in this notebook, and like literally by the pool in Las Vegas and on a vacation. And that's kind of where sort of the ideas came from. I've trailed like far away from where your original question was, but what was it again?
So I asked about the writing process, which you elaborated on, and yeah. I was just curious how it kind of like influenced the other concept albums that you've done.
Oh,
since.
Yeah, absolutely. So once, you know, I had this kind of idea, and then it ended up being real. I remember I told the band about it, and they thought I was completely out of my mind. Like they were like, "This is they didn't really believe in me that I was going to be able to pull it off." And I think that like Neil in particular was pretty annoyed when I kept talking about the concept. I kept using the word concept and using the word story. And I think he was like just kind of annoyed, with the whole like kind of thing. But yeah, so, you know, when we were doing the record, and I was so like, you know, 24 hours a day, I was thinking about this thing. Like I was dreaming about it, and I was, you know, up late at night, you know, like thinking, like tossing and turning in bed, thinking about, okay, is this song make sense? Is this lyric, you know, whatever. This is like kind of when I'm writing all the music, all the lyrics. And I had a lot of trouble sleeping, which is very much like Fight Club as well. And I remember there's like some studio documentaries that were actually released with the record, and there's a bunch of them where I'm like asleep on the studio couch, because I would stay up like all night not being able to sleep, and then I get to the studio and it'd be like all kind of warm and cozy in there, and I'd fall asleep, and I'd just, you know, because I was so immersed in the character and the writing. And it was a really hard time, like again for me, like I put everything into this. And when it was finally done, I was like, okay, I think this record is really good, but man, like having to do this, if I had to do this again, like it might kill me. Like, I don't know if I can get through this just with the lack of sleep and everything. So when it came time to make the next album, Rescue, Rescue is a little bit different too, because, you know, I mentioned before the thing about how we were free agents. And we weren't on Victory anymore, so we were now an unsigned artist. So we with Rescue, we actually had made a bunch of demos. So Rescue wasn't written all at once, like most of our albums. And so when we were starting to write Rescue, like I think we wrote like five or six songs, kind of right after Shipwreck came out. We wrote those songs, and then we kind of shopped them around, sent them to some different labels. And then about a year later, we wrote another, you know, five or six songs, and we pretty much had the entire Rescue album written, but it was written like, it wasn't written at all in the way a concept record was, which for me was really great and really easy. Cause I, you know, it was like, okay, just one song at a time. This song's good, you know, and instead of it being one concept, it was, you know, it was like 12 concepts, which is fine. And that's a fine way to make a record. So we did Rescue, and, you know, Rescue didn't speak to me the way that Shipwreck did. And not to say that there aren't some great songs on the record, and, you know, maybe some of the best songs we've ever done are on that record, actually. But in terms of a full album, a full entity, it didn't do what at all, you know, for me and for our, turns out our fans, that A Shipwreck in the Sand did. So once that happened, and it had been, you know, we're talking about like 4 years, since Shipwreck had come out, I was like, okay, I can get back on the saddle now, and I can do another concept record. Like, I have this in me again to do this. And that's when I had the idea for those South of Wind Shifts and the paired songs, and then the backward stuff, and then the songs that the one song that if you play it on top of the other song, it forms a third song. You know, like even crazier stuff than Shipwreck in the Sand was. So I think that Shipwreck gave me the confidence that I could do it. And and then with This How the Wind Shifts, that gave me, you know, even more confidence, I think, because that record is, I think, is my favorite one we've ever done. So, yeah. So I think that yeah, definitely Shipwreck paved the way for all the conceptual stuff that we did later on, including Dead Reflection, because Dead Reflection, a lot of people don't really understand, is quite a concept to it as well. So.
Okay, I didn't know that either.
Yeah, no one really. We didn't really talk about it. Nobody really asked, and like, but it is. Yeah, so you know, it is.
So was, you mentioned like the process of Shipwreck or of This Is How the Wind Shifts. Was it like, you mentioned that was like crazier ideas even than Shipwreck. So was it like a smoother process, or was it kind of similar in that it like took a lot out of you?
It was different. It was different. I think it took a lot out of me in sort of a different way. The one thing that, again, like the band thought I was absolutely crazy trying to do this, the two songs, they're called This Is How and The Wind Shifts. And when you put them together, they form This Is How the Wind Shifts they form a third song. So when I said to this, okay, I'm going to do this. They were like, what? How's that going to work? Like, you're trying to do like the Pink Floyd thing where if you play, you know, Dark Side of the Moon over The Wizard of Oz, it like lines up with the movie. You know, I'm sure you've heard about that. Like, they're like, what, you're trying to do something like that? Like, that's crazy. Like, you know, you're never going to be able to do that. And I said, well, you know, if I put one song in a minor key and the other one in the, you know, one in the major and the other in the relative minor, and I do this and this and this rhythm, like maybe I can pull this off. And then I did. But it was not without a lot of labor, and a lot of thinking and a lot of lack of sleep on that one too.
I remember being like super excited to rip the This Is How the Wind Shifts CD on my computer and throw the MP3s into Audacity and
right.
Hear like the doubled product. And I think I remember seeing, you mentioned Absolute Punk before, I think in their review of the album, they were like, these two songs are like really similar for no apparent reason. And I tweeted at them, I was like, you have to play them together.
right, yeah. No, that was cool. And that was cool. We ended up doing the 7-inch box set where we had the, you know, the paired songs on each side of the 7-inch and stuff. And then we had the one, like the single songs were single-sided so that you could play them on the same time with two record players. So yeah, that stuff was always really cool. But yeah, I mean, being able to do Shipwreck and have that work out was the way I got the confidence for that. You know, absolutely.
That's awesome. Yeah. And you mentioned a couple times being like free agents after this record. But then you ended up going with Victory for like the live album. How did that kind of decision come together?
Well, the honest truth is that Victory, you know, had the rights to the songs. So we kind of either had to put it out with them or get permission from them. So we ended up, yeah, we ended up doing a separate deal with them for the 10-year live album. And
gotcha.
And that's how that all came out. And that was a pretty cool experience too, actually. That was kind of in the same record cycle as Shipwreck in the Sand. Shipwreck in the Sand had been out for like a year or so, I think, when we did that, those shows, you know, the four shows where we played like all of our stuff. And that's still like the only time, the fourth night of that tour is still the only time that we've played a Shipwreck in the Sand in full, and the only time we ever played some of those songs. Like I don't think we ever played We Are Not the World and I Knew I Couldn't Trust You, and yeah, those songs, I think the only time we ever played those songs were at that show.
And then two, I'm guessing, probably.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. In the end, yeah, exactly. In the end, that's right. That's the only time we've ever played the end. yeah. We had Jackie Sandell sing it with us that night. That's cool. She came up from New York for it.
Oh yeah, that's really rad. And do you have like any specific memories of that night, like especially the shipwreck night? Like you said, it was almost like a year after the album came out. How were you kind of feeling about it at that point?
Super stressed about that whole experience. I was very, very happy when it was over and it worked out and everything was fine, because we'd planned four nights at this venue called the Alma Combo in Toronto, which is like a legendary venue. If there's like a CBGB of Toronto, and there isn't one, this is as close as it gets, you know? So we booked the four nights and we had to learn all of our songs again. We had to practice everything. We had to make sure everything was going to be, perfect. And it was a lot of rehearsal, especially on the songs that we'd never played before. And it was also like the shows were pretty long, especially at the time, because we were doing an entire album and then we'd walk off and we'd come back and we'd do, like the greatest hits of the songs that weren't on the album, So we'd come back and we'd play My Heroine or Smile in Your Sleep, or on the Discovering the Waterfront night, we'd come out and we'd play Smash to Pieces, that kind of stuff. So I was pretty nervous about it, because everything was getting recorded. And I was really concerned about my voice too, and doing the four nights in a row, these long shows, I was just concerned that my voice was going to get blown out or something was going to go wrong with it. And then when we finally finished that fourth show, I remember we went out for dinner after, and I was like so stoked that it all worked out, and we didn't make too many mistakes.
Yeah, definitely. I think it was the first time in a long time that I listened to it recently, and the vocals were like really to the front in like the mix of the audio, and I thought they sounded really great. I was kind of surprised like how good they sounded for being a live album.
Well, there's some auto-tune on them. definitely auto-tune for sure. But we could have good vocals sound great, or like okay vocals sound okay, which would you rather have? it's fine. Virtually every record, live record ever is done like that now. So,
for sure. did that help you guys prepare a little bit for like the Discovering the Waterfront 10 and the When Broken Jesus Fix 15 tour?
I think it put it in our minds that was something that could be done. It's kind of interesting though, because at the time that we did that, no bands had been doing the 10-year anniversary tours. Like the only band I could remember that had done that was Jimmy Eat World did a Clarity tour, and they but it was really short. They did like 10 shows, and they played like small venues. And they played Clarity from front to back, which was one of my favorite records of all time. And I remember hearing about that and being like, that is so cool that they're doing that. And they're, especially like it's their old stuff that, was never on the radio, never mainstream. It's cool that they're doing that for their fans like me that care about the record. So I wasn't able to go to the shows. There were none like near me, but I thought that was really cool. And then that's kind of where we had the idea to do the whole 10-year thing, and to do four nights and play an album each night, because it wasn't until after that remember Taking Back Sunday, I guess it was like 2012, I think, when they did the Tell All Your Friends 10-year anniversary tour. And then after that, it seemed like everybody was doing that, and then of course we did it as well. But we'd actually just randomly played Discovering the Waterfront in full. Like we'd just show up one day and be like, let's do this today, and we would just do it. Like I remember we played LA one time and we just said, hey, we're just gonna do this, play this record right now, like, and nobody knew.
That's really cool.
Nobody knew. And then it was we did that a few times, because we always would switch our set lists too. And after the we did the four shows where we played everything, well, it was cool, because we were like, okay, we literally know how to play all of our songs well, so why would we write a set list for a whole tour? Let's just play whatever we want to play that day. So we did. So we you know, I don't know if you went on, if you go on setlist.fm, if it's complete, but I'm sure if you look around 2010 and after, like post those Toronto shows, if you looked at our set list, I bet they're all like radically, radically different.
Yeah, I mean, that makes a lot of sense. That's like super cool. It's always been something that I've appreciated, like that seeing different songs every time I see you guys play. And then I have just a couple of kind of like random questions about the album.
Yeah, yeah, sure, of course.
On like allmusic.com, it shows Silverstein's original guitarist Richard McWalter as having like a composing credit on the end. Is
yeah.
that in any way accurate?
Yes. Great. Wow. That's really, really, wow. That's really astute of you. Yeah. So Rich, yeah, Richard was our original guitar player, and he's amazing. He's an amazing person, and an amazing guitar player. So creative. And to me, like, you know, he was the most important part of our band when we started. I think he was the reason that we stood out, because some of the guitar parts he wrote were so cool. You know, whether it's like the intro and outro to "Wish I Could Forget You," which is, you know, really cool, clean part that he wrote, and you know, he's amazing. So he I guess I'll tell you the background of why he left the band. So he was in the band for our first demo, which you can hear those songs in all their horrible recorded glory on the 18 Candles. We reissued those recordings. And so he played on that, and we wrote those songs together. And, you know, we had a little bit of local kind of hype, and we played a bunch of shows. And then, you know, this is just like, this is in the year 2000. So we started the band in the early 2000. And then in September of 2000, me and Rich were the same age, and we had just finished high school. So we were both going to university. So I was going to University of Guelph, which is only about 45 minutes away from, you know, where we were from. And Richard was going to Victoria, BC, on the other side of the country, like a 5-hour flight away. Oh, wow. To study engineering. So we thought that basically the band, we never really thought was going to go anywhere anyway, because we knew that I was going to school, Rich was going to school, Josh, Paul, and Billy, they were all younger. Actually, Billy wasn't even in the band yet, but they were all younger than us, so they were still in high school. So, you know, that was fine, you know. And so then we had plans that after going to first semester of school, Richard was coming back, and we were playing a show in December, like around Christmas time. And so, you know, we were excited, and over the like whatever 4 months that we didn't do any shows, you know, the word of mouth had grown a little bit more about the band. And we played, and it was a great show. I think it was Bill's first show, actually, December 27th, 2000. And after we played, Richard said to me, yo, so I'm not coming home next summer. I'm staying in BC. Oh, wow. I'm going to work out there. I've got, like, a job and stuff. So, you know. And I was... You know, we were disappointed because the plan was like, okay, we're going to record some more stuff, and we're going to, you know, do our first tour. So when Rich said that, I'm like, okay, well, I guess like maybe this is just going to be the end of the band. And he said, you know, if you guys want to find someone else, like, I won't be mad. You know, it's not like we're going to get signed to Victory or anything. Direct quote. He literally said that. So he was like, you know, so that's when, I called Neil, and I got Neil in the band, and, you know, we went through, you know, there's the rest is history, as they say, but while we were working on, this, you know, this other stuff. Like we recorded the 6-song, you know, demo EP. And after that, we had had a few other things that Richard had written and, you know, me and him were working on together. And one of them was The End. And Richard wrote the music for that. And it was in a really strange tuning, where you tune the top, like the low string, you tune it actually up to F, which is very like up a semitone, which is a very, very unconventional thing to do to a guitar. It's been a very strange tuning. And I was really intrigued by the kind of the way that it sounded. So, you know, when Rich left the band, I was like, hey, man, so, you know, that acoustic song you wrote, I really like it. And I really, you know, it's your song and whatever. I'd really like to use it if that's okay. So keep in mind, this is like the year 2001. So like we're still 2 years away from our first album even coming out. But I said, I'd really like to, you know, use this song. So I remember I listened to the like shitty, like ghetto blaster demo that we had made for the song. And I figured out how to play it. And he told me what the tuning was, because I wouldn't be able to figure it out without knowing what the tuning was. So I figured out this song, and I remember I had one of the first titles was called Learning to Hurt, was one of the first titles I wrote with a bunch of different lyrics, sort of different melodies. And I had this kind of idea of the song. So when we were doing the first album, I actually tracked a scratch guitar for that song, for The End, which turned into The End. And so the first album, it was supposed to be on the first album. It was supposed to be the last track. And we were going to cut. What song were we going to cut from the first album? I can't remember. Might have been November, actually. We were going to cut November because we wanted to make a 10-song album. And we were going to have The End would have been the last track. And I remember I recorded all the guitar, and then Paul recorded the drums, like the ending drum thing, which was different, but not that much different. And I'm going on and on about this, but I never talked about this before. And
interesting.
So that, I don't know. In the end, I don't know what happened. I think we kind of ran out of time. The first record was made kind of crazy too. Like we kind of ran out of time on the first album. And then when it came time, so I kind of just forgot about it. And then when it came time to make the second record with Discovering the Waterfront, I was like, hey, remember this acoustic song? And everyone's like, oh yeah, yeah. I'm like, I think it's really good. Like, I think we should put it on the record. And again, I demoed it. And again, like we recorded the guitar for it. And then again, it just, I don't know, it just didn't end up getting finished.
Oh, wow.
And then the third record, I think we didn't bother trying it. I think that, like, we were like, this ship has sailed. And then when the fourth record was, you know, Chipper in the Sand was, we were writing that, I was like, okay. So I know this song is like literally 7 years old, and it hasn't worked out. But I'm like, I really think there's something here, and I would like to you know, actually do this one this time. Mm-hmm. And Cameron, because he produced Chipper in the Sand, and he produced Discovering the Waterfront, he remembered the acoustic song from Discovering the Waterfront. Like he remembered recording it, and he was like, oh yeah, that actually like is a pretty cool, like, you know, that's got a cool vibe to it, so like maybe we should do it. So finally that happened, and I remember I played it for Rich, because we're still like Rich, I still see Rich, like he lives in Boston area now, and we still see him like when we're out there and stuff. So we've been friends like the whole time. And I remember he was living in Australia at the time, and this is before the record came out. We were in Australia, I guess probably the beginning of 2009. And I played it for him, and he laughed, and he said, dude, and I, he's like, that's like, you've like played it completely wrong. So like I had referenced like the tape, the cassette tape recording that he just made like for me, or not even for me, just made like in the year 2000. And he's like, oh yeah, that's like that chord you play there is that's like not the right chord or whatever. And it, like, of course it doesn't really matter, but it's just funny that I you know, just played it. I played it like, you know, maybe not wrong, but different from, you know, what he had originally written. So there you go. That's why, yeah, he's got a songwriting credit, because he wrote pretty much all the music for that song.
That's crazy. That's so perfect that you mentioned about like the wrong chord, because I was watching like the making of documentary earlier today, and there was like one point where it was either Paul or Neil. You were like, "No, that you're playing that pattern completely wrong."
Oh, it was Bill. Oh yeah, I was. Oh, I look like such a dick. I was like, "That's wrong. That's wrong. Everything's wrong." I like say something like that. Yeah. I was so mean to Billy. And then I remember it's such a funny moment, and I know that like fans won't really understand this, so I want to put the context in it. But so I'm sitting behind Bill on the couch, like probably laying down like an asshole, and so Bill's playing something wrong, and and I, you know, and I'm like complaining. So Cameron's like, okay, well, like, let's, you know, he's trying to defuse the situation. He's like, well, it's okay. Like, you know, let's move on. Let's move on to something else. So he's reading the songs, like off that like, okay, let's just move to a new song, Bill. You can record something else. So he's reading the working titles for the songs. So the working titles were always like ridiculous. And one of the songs, actually, We Are Not the World, that was called Poo Bum, was the working title. So there's a part where Cameron's like, okay, well, Bill, what do you want to work on next? We got this, Poo Bum, this. And Bill goes, Poo Bum, I guess. And it's like funny because we don't think about how ridiculous the working titles are, but that's just so funny that that's in the documentary, like that moment, and it's just very funny. And I'd love to go back and watch that documentary again.
It was definitely quite the experience. I feel very 2009 between watching that and all the other research that I did.
Yeah, I know. It's amazing how much, you know, everything's changed in 10 years. You know, just how we listen to music. You know, this was still the CD era. You know. Like there was some digital. Actually, one thing we could talk about too, if you want to go real deep, is the B-sides that we did for this record.
Yeah, and definitely.
We did so. Victory wanted extra songs, like for Arrivals and Departures, we had those, you know, three extra songs I talked about: Rain Will Fall, Falling Down, and then Broken Stars, which we didn't use. So for this record, Shipwreck in the Sand, they wanted it, but it didn't really make sense for us to write more original songs that if they worked with the story or the concept, then, well, they couldn't be B-sides. And then I didn't really want to take myself out of, you know, they say like out of character. I didn't want to really take myself out of the story and start writing songs just about whatever. So we decided to do cover songs. So that's why they were actually on the iTunes exclusive. Because iTunes was just starting to become like a big thing, really popular.
Yeah, yeah.
And if you pre-ordered the record on iTunes, then you got the covers we did, which we recorded them all with the Shipwreck sessions. So we did Help by the Beatles. We did Go Your Own Way by Fleetwood Mac. We did a No Effects song, which I did acoustic. And we did a Saves the Day song, which I did acoustic. And it was, yeah, and the other thing we recorded at the same time as Shipwreck is we recorded our Apologize cover. So that was actually recorded alongside Shipwreck too, so it's the same drums and production and everything on there.
That's really interesting to know. I didn't know that, and it was funny. I was watching, again, as I said, I was watching the documentary, and like I noticed Paul Mark in there doing part of the gang vocals for, like,
yeah,
the Beatles cover or whatever.
Yeah, that's right. That's totally right. Yeah, they... There's like a part, I think, when I'm like, when Josh is like on his phone, like while he's doing like the group vocals. He's like, he's like on his BlackBerry. Yeah, and then it's a bunch of guys from Paul Mark and Paul Mark's old band. Those guys are in it too, which is it's kind of funny. I remember that now. I'm like explaining to them what the words are.
Yeah, on the Wikipedia page, it's like, though it's not technically like a credited appearance, this was the first time Paul Mark was on a Silverstein record.
I guess that's true. I never I never thought about that, but yeah, I guess that's absolutely true.
And I had just a quick question about the end of the album, like story-wise. I feel like there's kind of some ambiguity to... I've seen people reference the main character committing suicide, but I've also seen people reference him like succumbing to his illness.
Yeah.
Do you care to shed light on that?
Well, you know, I'll tell you something really funny about this whole story is I wrote it. And I usually when I write things, I like to leave some things open to interpretation. And a lot of times I'll write something and it'll have like minimum two meanings. And sometimes you're talking about three, four meanings within just like one phrase or one line. Like, so I write things intentionally that can be taken different ways. However, with Shipwreck of the Sand, I actually was trying to do that a lot less. I was trying not to make things too ambiguous. I was trying to write in a way that was like, okay, this is the story. Just like when you see a movie, like, and someone, you know, is, something happens, well, that happens. You know, it's not just an interpretation, it's an event. So, inevitably, with the format of a song, and it's an audio component, and there's no visual, you know, people are going to take things differently. And what I thought was so funny was, once the record came out, and people kind of got a little obsessed with it, and they started writing their own versions of the stories, and like there was somebody that wrote like a fucking whole novel like based on it, and
oh really?
Yeah, and I don't know if it ever came out or anything, but they sent me a copy of it, and what was funny was I started using some of the shit that they said, even though I didn't intend on it. So I was like, oh, that's kind of better than my version. I'm just going to say that it's that. And then what's funny is over the years, I started forgetting which was the real, like the real one in terms of how I wrote it, and which was the one that someone interpreted that I was like, oh, that's kind of a good take. I'm just going to use that. Like if someone asked me in an interview or something, right? Right. So it's funny answering it now because I haven't talked about the record in so long, you know, like I talked about the record a lot when it came out, and then over the years, like, you know, it doesn't get brought up in interviews like to this depth. So, with the end of the record, I'm talking a little bit slowly and I'll have to think it through a little bit because I didn't do any research before this interview. like the whole thing about the record is there's this post-apocalyptic, thing going on, right? And in the first song, there's the pre-choruses. It's like as I see the whatever, fuck, what is the line? it's like referencing the planes in the sky. That's gonna happen in the end. I say I can see it coming to the end in the song, which is the first track is directly foreshadowing the last track, which is called The End, right? The planes take over the sky. Is that what I say? I don't remember
yes,
the first song, but the exact line. But I referenced that, and then in the last track, of course, when I say "planes fill the sky, we'll both die tonight. We'll both die tonight." Well, it's sort of more like this. You know, they're having this conversation, him and his wife, and in the end, it's kind of like the military is coming in with planes and there's kind of like a bombing, you know, like a drone attack. And that's kind of when they say, well, we'll both die tonight. is based on
okay.
is based on that. However, is that really happening? Or is this just a hallucination that is in his mind, you know, about this event happening? Like, is there really the government and airplanes and everything out to get him? Or is this just in his head, this whole idea of, you know, the end of the world? Right.
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of that's another the thing why it's called the end, because it's like the end of the world. So that's kind of an interesting take is does he die from like the government military, like killing him, like, you know, in a war type of event? Or does he die from an illness, you know, his own illness? The suicide angle, actually, I don't believe I ever thought about that, about it, him taking his own life.
Yeah, I saw that referenced in like a lot of reviews, but it wasn't anything that I had ever picked up on either.
No, and you know what? To be honest, I would never write that, because you know, as early as our first record, there were some references that I would make to hurting yourself or self harm or you know, suicide, and then that carried over into the second record a lot too. In fact, there's even like a suicide hotline number in our second record in the reissue. You know, and I even kind of say like, hey, if you're having suicidal thoughts, like you should talk to somebody. And that's, because that's something that's so near and dear to my heart, that issue, I don't think I would write that character. I wouldn't write that character to kill himself, because that's not to me, that's not a good ending of anything. Both in real life and in a story, you know. Although Sons of Anarchy was a pretty good ending, but sorry, more spoilers. But I think like that's kind of the gist of the story is there's a lot going on in the world and the government, and like, you know, there's things that I talk about with, you know, like I mentioned in Born Dead, with the healthcare system and you know, there's stuff with his daughter in the story, and there's a lot to take in, but the mental health aspect of it, there are times in it where it's like, okay, is this really happening, or is this just in his head? And I'm gonna leave most of that open to interpretation.
I mean, it's really interesting you saying that stuff, like that makes sense. As far as like my understanding of the lyrics and stuff, I actually saw in one of the like early interviews you had done about the album, you mentioned having like one notebook that you'd spent like the last year or so, like writing all the concepts and ideas for the album in. And you were like, oh, maybe one day we'll like auction it off for charity or something. Is that something that you still track of?
Yeah, the notebook that I wrote everything in. Yeah, I have that notebook somewhere still. I don't know if I ever want to part with it, though, to be honest, if that's selfish, because that's going to be pretty cool to look at in like 10 years, 20 years, whatever, to see that again and remember.
And I think just the last kind of overarching question I had about the album is kind of like the artwork. You went with Martin Whitfooth, who has done pretty much everything, I think, besides Dead Reflection.
Yeah.
Could you talk a little about like your collaboration with him and your working relationship?
Yeah, absolutely. He's amazing. He's an amazing person, amazing artist. And what was pretty cool about you know, all the records really, but this one in particular was, most of the records had been his idea. We would send. That's not really true. Some of them records were his idea. Like, I'm Alive and Everything I Touch was his idea to have the monolithic structure and the Ouroboros. And he thought the buffalo kind of thing worked for that. And then for Wind Shifts and then Rescue, you know, he thought the carrier pigeon was cool. And, you know, like a bunch of the concepts and Arrivals and Departures to have the train, that was his idea. But with Shipwreck in the Sand, I said the cover's got to be a burning house. And that's like the start of the story. And, you know, there's basically there's got to be this burning house, and then there's got to be airplanes in the back, like, you know, in the sky. That there's got to be that on there. So that's why it was, you know, that's why it was done that way. And I can't recall all the artwork inside because I've just been so long since I looked at it. But a bunch of the artwork inside was a lot of it was, you know, based on the story, and based on a lot of it was based on his interpretation of the lyrics as well. But, you know, another thing we didn't mention, which I think maybe would confuse some people, is the title of the record being A Shipwreck in the Sand, which seemingly doesn't have anything to do with like a burning house, you know, like you'd think like, oh, yeah, it's called A Shipwreck in the Sand. OK, well, then put A Shipwreck in the Sand on the cover. You know, that would make more sense, I guess, just from the strict title. But, you know, that's actually that part of the story is when he's reading a story book. There's actually even a sample at the beginning. You could barely hear of a page turning. If you listened to really closely to the beginning of the song, A Shipwreck in the Sand. And that's when he's reading a story to his daughter. And the story is an analogy for kind of what he's going through with his family. You know, and basically his wife sort of planning a mutiny, on his, you know, on his life and his relationship with her and their daughter.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think that was kind of like, at least when I first listened to the album, I think that was kind of a little bit of a point of confusion as to like whether that was a separate story or like how it kind of worked into the story.
Yeah, well, that was, it's a really important part. And that, like I said, that was kind of the thing that we used as the teaser to launch the record, you know, but the record is not about a shipwreck in the sand at all. You know, that's just a story and in a story within a story, I guess.
Yeah, but I guess it works well as like a, like you said, kind of like a metaphor to the story in a way to like nicely tie it up and summarize it. Yeah,
that's exactly what it is.
For this week's mid-show shout out, I want to praise The Alternative. The Alternative has been my favorite music site for a long time, well before I started writing for them. The site's dedication to independent music journalism is everything that is great about this music scene as a whole. And all of their support and encouragement for this podcast is part of what inspired me to make it a reality. Whether you're looking for interviews, reviews, commentary, or a new favorite band, The Alternative is truly the best place for you to find it. So please go follow the site on Twitter, @GetAlternative, or just add getalternative.com to your bookmarks. If you're so inclined, your support for the site's Patreon is endlessly appreciated. Any amount is welcome, but at the $5 a month level, you get a free digital album each month and a shirt each year, so that's an amazing bang for your buck. I'd like to extend my gratitude and love to The Alternative, and I know that you will love the community around it as much as I do.
Was there anything else that any other memories that have come up as we were talking or anything that you feel obliged to share?
No, not particularly. I can remember one sort of interesting story that I can share that I don't think I've ever talked about, but there's this little interlude, I guess you'd call it, track that's at the beginning. And it's called Their Lips Sink Ships. Mm-hmm. And the where it came from, it's like, you know, fly away, leave this bloody path behind your wing, you know. That actually came up, was inspired by Josh being in his house where he lived. And I guess he somehow a bird like came into his house, and he still doesn't know how it got there. And it like came in and it started freaking out and then just flew right into the, like, I guess the window or something, and like splattered and was like blood everywhere. And he like, he was just like, what? Like, and it was, you know, it was like a sparrow. And it was like, I guess I really like, he looked it up and it was like a super, super bad omen, like in a lot of like cultures or whatever, to have a sparrow fly in your house and die. So that's actually where he came in the studio, like kind of freaked out about it one day. And then that's why I wrote those words for that little interlude.
Oh, wow. That's super cool. He actually inspired the lyrics at the end of Vices too, didn't he? I'd rather sleep on the streets.
on a much more humorous note. That's right. Yeah, I'll I'd rather sleep on the street. That's based on Josh, I'll tell this one quickly. I know we've been on the phone for like a long time, but Josh and I were in Japan and everyone was kind of tired and jet lagged, but Josh had like a friend there that was from Canada, and she was trying to bug us to like come out and hang. So we're like, all right. So we took like multiple subway trains to get to this Roppongi or like part of Tokyo. And we're at this club and it's like me, Josh, and this, his friend, and then this, like our Japanese handler, like translator. So we're there doing this. And then all of a sudden we can't find Josh. And I mean, we're drinking very heavily too, I should add. It's important to the story. And we can't find Josh. So we're looking everywhere. We have no idea. So finally it's like, well, I don't really want to leave Josh like in Tokyo alone, you know? And the other thing is like, we don't have phones, like our own phones, like with texting or anything. Like, in Japan at the time, they were using a different band, so you couldn't just bring your phone over there and use it, even if like you want to pay roaming, it like just wouldn't work. So we actually had phone rentals, so you would rent like just a regular flip phone that you could just make calls on it. It was just so we could call each other if like, you know, something happened, like this. But of course we call Josh and he doesn't answer the phone. So we're like, I don't know what to do. So we're like, well, maybe he went back to the hotel. So we go back to the hotel. He's not there. I'm like, shit, I don't know what to do. Well, I guess I'm just going to like, you know, go to sleep. So I guess like a few hours later, I was sleeping. Josh just came in and, you know, in the morning, and he had fallen asleep on the street. Just literally like went outside, was tired, laid down in an alley. And he said he woke up because the sun like went in was in his eyes in the morning, and he woke up and he was just surrounded by like Japanese business people like walking around him, like just like nothing happened. He said his wallet was in his hand, like as he was sleeping, and and his face hurt from being on the concrete. He said he got up right away and just started walking and like. Somehow found the hotel. I don't know how you would find the hotel. Like, you're in random ass Japan. Like, it was so funny. And I don't know how, like, it was, we took multiple trains to get there. I don't know how he found his way back just walking, but he did. And that's why we wrote the lyrics at the end of Vices.
That sounds like so much like something that would happen in a movie.
those were the days. I think we were on tour with Avril Lavigne in Japan at the time too. How weird is that?
Yeah, I mean that makes sense from what I know scheduling wise. Thank you so much for taking the time to talk. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, no, thank you for your interest in this record. It's a record that means a lot to me. I think it was the first record that we ever made or I ever made in my life that I felt a lot of confidence and I felt like really good about. So it's cool that, you know, 10 years later people are still celebrating it.
Okay, I know that was a long one, but it was so much fun, right? I truly hope you enjoyed it as much as I did, and I want to thank you for sticking around and supporting Fly on the Call for these past 10 episodes. There's so much more in the works that I'm excited for, so please stay tuned. And if you haven't ever listened to A Shipwreck in the Sand, please rectify that as soon as you can. It's a work of art. I'd like to thank Shane for taking the time to talk, being so open, and giving such in-depth answers. It was so much fun to transport myself back to 2009, and I hope you enjoyed the trip too. Happy 10 years to A Shipwreck in the Sand, and just about 20 to Silverstein. Thank you for all the memories you've given me. Don't forget to enter the giveaway via the pinned tweet at twitter.com/flyonthecallpod. And check back Monday for a hint at next week's guest. A special thank you as always to The Alternative for helping to promote the show, Kaylin West of Tiny Stills for the theme song, and Michaela Jane Palermo for the artwork. You can keep up to date by subscribing to the podcast and following the show on Twitter and Instagram at Fly on the Call Pod. Feel free to email any questions, comments, or other feedback to me at flyonthecallpod@gmail.com. I don't know who needs to hear this, but you rock. Fly on the call.
Hello, everybody. I'm Bruce.
And I'm Nolan, and this is the Corner of Gray Street podcast. As longtime Dave Matthews Band fans, we set out to create a podcast to dive deep into the past, present, and future of DMB.
Not only do we recap and review shows within an ongoing tour, but we revisit past shows from throughout the band's history, conduct interviews with a wide variety of guests with ties to DMB, and create unique and exclusive content like our Concerts on the Corner series.
Whether you're a fan of the band or just a fan of great music, we think you'll find something you'll enjoy. We can't wait to see you on the corner of Gray Street.